101 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Dan Novak joins us for an education story. He looks at the problems some American schools had keeping track of homeless students during the COVID-19 pandemic. Then John Russell is here with this week's Everyday Grammar. He looks at the different ways we can describe the act of cleaning. To close the program, Katie and Ann Ball tell us about an important national park in Florida, the Everglades. But first, here's Jill Robbins.
Not far from Camp David, a U.S. presidential base in Maryland, lie the remains of an iron workshop called Catoctin Furnace. The workshop dates back to the late 18th century. It is an important place for understanding the start of the Industrial Revolution in early U.S. history. The site is also providing researchers with a greater understanding of African American history. A new study examined DNA from the remains of 27 individuals found in a burial place at Catoctin Furnace for enslaved people. The study revealed the ancestry of some of the enslaved people who were forced to work there in the years after the nation's founding. It also identified thousands of living relatives. Many of the relatives still live in Maryland. The burial site was used from 1774 to 1850. The remains were removed from the site in the 1970s so that a road could be built. Since then, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., has kept the remains. They include 16 males and 11 females. Some are very young children, while others are older adults. Researchers found that the 27 individuals descended from just a few African populations, mainly West Africa's Wolof and Mandinka peoples and Central Africa's Congo people. And they have strong genetic connections to present-day populations in Senegal, Gambia, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Millions of people were forcibly taken from Africa to the Americas from the 16th to 19th century in the transatlantic slave trade. A lack of documentation about these people has left descendants with little information about their own family history. Carrie Bruelhide is a researcher with the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. She helped write the study, which appeared last week in the publication Science. Bruelhide said, "This knowledge was severed by slavery, a truth that has implications for African Americans far beyond the community of Catoctin Furnace." She added that the study shows the power of genetic research to rebuild some of what was destroyed by a lack of record keeping. Enslaved people of African descent were forced to work in agricultural, industrial, and home settings in parts of the United States. Slavery ended with the U.S. Civil War, which was fought from 1861 to 1865. Catoctin Furnace is a few kilometers from Camp David in Cunningham Falls State Park. It grew into a village area with industrial buildings and housing. Workers mined iron, kept fires burning to melt the iron, and made different kinds of goods. The goods they made included stoves, pots, and even cannonballs. Enslaved people were the main part of the workforce until paying European immigrants to work there became less costly by the mid-19th century. For this study, the researchers examined historical DNA alongside genetic testing company 23andMe's personal ancestry database. Through their efforts, they identified 41,799 Americans related to the 27 individuals. A. Dean Harney was the lead study writer. She is also a 23andMe population geneticist. She said, "Enslaved African Americans are largely excluded from the historical record, and in documents where they are mentioned, they are often treated as property, not as people." The study found some European ancestry in most of the 27 individuals. That finding supports records of sexual abuse of enslaved people by their enslavers and others. It found that some of the 27 had possible genes for genetic conditions like sickle cell anemia and G6PD deficiency. Genetic conditions involving red blood cell problems are still common among African Americans. Catherine Barca is a Smithsonian researcher and a writer of the study. She said, "The experiences of African Americans within the early industrial complex of the United States are not completely understood, and their labors in this system have not been thoroughly explored or acknowledged." Barca added, "We hope this paper gives voice to these 27 individuals." I'm Jill Robbins.
During the coronavirus pandemic, many schools struggled to keep a count of students whose families struggled with homelessness. The number of children identified as homeless by schools nationwide dropped by 21% from the 2018-2019 school year to the 2020-2021 school year, federal data found. That decrease represented more than 288,000 students. But it is likely there were many students whose schools did not know they were homeless. By the time Aaliyah Ibarra started second grade, her family had moved 5 times in 4 years in search of housing. As she was about to start a new school, her mother, Bridget Ibarra, saw how much it was affecting Aaliyah's education. At 8 years old, Aaliyah did not know the alphabet. Her family's struggles came during the COVID-19 pandemic, which forced Aaliyah to begin school online. Online school was especially hard for Aaliyah because she was homeless. And like thousands of other students across the country, her school did not know. By not being identified as homeless, such students lose out on important support like transportation, clothes, cleaning services, and other help. 2 years later, the effects have worsened. Students nationwide have struggled to make up for missed learning, and educators have lost important time identifying who needs the most help. Schools are offering services like tutoring and counseling, but schools now have limited time left to spend federal pandemic assistance money for homeless students, said Barbara Duffield. She is director of Schoolhouse Connection, a national homelessness organization. Many education leaders, Duffield said, do not even know about federal money meant to support homeless students. The federal support ends next year. In Bridget Ibarra's case, she chose not to tell the school her children were homeless. She said that teachers never asked. She was worried if officials knew the family was staying in a shelter, the family would face pressure to attend a different school that was closer to the shelter. The stigma that comes with homelessness also can lead families not to tell anyone they do not have housing, Duffield said. If schools cannot identify homeless children, we can't ensure that they have everything they need to be successful in school and even go to school, Duffield added. Aaliyah's school is in Phoenix, Arizona. It's continued with online learning for her whole kindergarten year. Aaliyah and her older brother spent most of their school days on computers in a temporary classroom at the shelter. While the shelter helped the family meet their basic needs, Ibarra said she often asked the school for extra help for her daughter. She felt the school was giving all its attention to Aaliyah's older brother because he is a special education student. That means he has been identified as needing extra educational support. The school's principal, Sean Hannafin, said school officials met often with the children's mom. He said they offered the support they had available. But he said it was hard to know online which students required more help. There is a federal law aimed at making sure homeless students have equal access to education. The law provides rights and services to children without a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. Many students are not identified as homeless when they sign up for school. At school, teachers or other school workers often notice students who may be dealing with difficulties at home. But with children learning online, teachers often could not see signs of problems. Overall, the drop in the student homelessness count began before the pandemic, but it became greater when the pandemic began. The percentage of enrolled students identified as homeless in the U.S. dropped from 2.7% in 2018-2019 to 2.2% in 2020-2021. Over that time, Arizona had one of the biggest drops in the number of students identified as homeless. Eventually, Bridget Ibarra had to send Aaliyah to a different school after moving to find new housing. At Aaliyah's new school, Fry Elementary, Principal Alexis Cruz Freeman saw how hard it was to communicate with families when children were not in classrooms. Aaliyah has improved at her new school, Cruz Freeman said. She still has trouble saying and reading some words. But by the end of the school year, she was able to read a text and write 4 sentences based on its meaning. She is also performing at her grade level in math. Cruz Freeman considers Aaliyah a success story in part because of her mother's support. She was an advocate for her children, which is all that we can ever ask for, Cruz Freeman said. I'm Dan Novak.
Whether you enjoy it or not, cleaning is an activity that all of us have to do from time to time. As a result, we should explore how to talk about it. In this Everyday Grammar, you will learn about different kinds of verbs we use to talk about cleaning. Let's start with the verb clean. We can think of clean as a kind of general term for many activities. For example, a person might say,
I am cleaning my house.
Aside from clean, we can use a number of more exact verbs. For example, we have sweep, vacuum, wash, and dust. Let's explore each of these in turn. We use the verb sweep when we remove dust or dirt with a broom. We use vacuum when we clean something with a special device known as a vacuum cleaner. We use wash when we clean something with water and soap. We use dust when we make something clean by wiping the surface, often with cloth. So, we have a group of verbs. Clean is the widest in meaning. The others describe more exact activities: sweep, vacuum, dust, and so on. You might be asking yourself how this discussion connects with grammar. The question leads us to an important point. We have a group of verbs. These verbs are interesting because all of them can be used in a transitive or an intransitive sense. Transitive means to take a direct object. Intransitive means to not take a direct object. What this means is that the verbs we have explored, clean, sweep, dust, and so on, have some sense of flexibility in how they can be used. Let's clarify. Think back to the sentence you heard earlier.
I am cleaning my house.
In the example, we have the subject, I, the present progressive form, am cleaning, and the object, my house. In this sentence, we can say that the verb clean is followed by an object. But we could also say,
I am cleaning.
In this example, we do not have an object. Now, let us take some of the other verbs we explored earlier. They all follow the same general idea. The verb sweep might be used with an object, as in,
she swept the floor.
Or without an object, as in,
she swept.
The same idea is true of vacuum, where a person might say,
I vacuumed the living room.
Or,
I vacuumed.
The main difference between the statements is in the amount of shared information. If the speaker and listener both know what is being discussed, then the object is not necessary. If the listener does not know what is being discussed, then the speaker might need to include the object. Let's take some time to work with these ideas. Make a sentence using the present progressive form of the verb dust. Be sure to use the object, the bookshelf. Pause the audio to consider your answer. Here is one answer.
I am dusting the bookshelf.
Today you learned a few basic ideas that are important for talking about cleaning. You learned some related verbs and how to use them with or without an object. The next step will be to develop more complex sentences that involve adverbs and prepositions. But that will have to be the subject of a future report. I'm John Russell.
Today, on our National Parks journey, we explore the Everglades in South Florida. When many people think of Florida, images of sandy coasts, theme parks, and rocket launches come to mind. But it is also home to a natural wilderness different from any other in the United States. Everglades National Park is the largest subtropical wilderness in the U.S. Several rare and endangered species live in the park. It is a huge place, covering more than 600,000 hectares of wetlands. It is also a popular park. More than 1 million visitors pass through the official entrances every year. But others enter the park on water and go uncounted.
In 1947, President Harry Truman spoke at the official opening of Everglades National Park. He said, "The goal of creating the park was to protect forever a wild area that could never be replaced." The Everglades is considered one of the biological wonders of the world. It is a place where plants and animals from the Caribbean Sea share an ecosystem with native North American species. 9 different environments exist within the Everglades. They include mangrove and cypress swamps, estuaries, and coastal marshes.
In the 1940s, reporter and environmentalist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote a book called The Everglades, River of Grass. She described the area as the liquid heart of Florida. Everglades National Park was created to protect an ecosystem from damage. The Everglades is home to about 30 species that federal officials say are threatened or endangered. They include the Florida panther, the American crocodile, and the West Indian manatee. More than 350 bird species and 300 species of fresh and saltwater fish live within the park. The Everglades is also home to 40 species of mammals and 50 reptile species.
Visitors to the Everglades will see many exotic plants. They include what is said to be the largest growth of mangrove trees in the Western world. Gumbo limbo trees, known for their peeling red skin. Strangler figs and royal palms are also among the area's plant life. The country's largest living mahogany tree also lives in the Everglades. Sawgrass grows in some areas of the park. Be careful. Sawgrass is very sharp, with teeth just like a saw. It can grow up to 4 meters tall. With about 1.5 meters of rainfall each year, plants and trees never stop growing in the Everglades. The dry winter season is the favorite of most visitors, when insects like mosquitoes are less of a problem. The rainy season lasts from June to November.
There are many ways to explore the Everglades. Visitors can see alligators while hiking the Anhinga Trail. The park is one of the only places in the world where freshwater alligators and saltwater crocodiles live in the same area. Visitors using canoes are likely to observe large groups of wading birds, like the wood stork or the great blue heron. Bright pink flamingos also thrive in the Everglades. Some visitors might enjoy riding bicycles through Shark Valley. Others might want to take it more slowly. The boardwalk walking trail goes right over the slow-moving water. Visitors can take a close look at insects and other wildlife. The park also offers tram rides for guided tours.
The National Park Service says that early colonial settlers and land developers believed the Everglades had little value. The settlers had plans to remove water from the area. In the 1880s, developers began digging canals to reduce water levels. At the time, they did not understand the complexity of the Everglades ecosystem. As a result, they were not prepared for all the work. They caused environmental problems. Larger efforts to drain the wetlands continued between 1905 and 1910. Farms were built on large pieces of land. More people began to move to the Everglades. More changes came mid-century. The federal government built roads, canals, and water control systems throughout South Florida. The project was aimed at providing water and flood protection for people and farms. Workers built a huge system of waterways and pumping stations to control the overflow of Lake Okeechobee north of the Everglades.
In more recent years, environmental experts learned about the damage to the Everglades. Some experts say the balance of nature in the area has been destroyed. Today, some of South Florida's early wetland areas no longer exist. Populations of wading birds have been reduced by 90%. Whole populations of animals are in danger of disappearing. In 2000, Congress approved a plan to restore and improve the Everglades. Federal, state, and other organizations are partners in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. The future is not clear for the wild and beautiful Everglades, but efforts are underway to protect this biological treasure. The hope is that people may continue to visit the extraordinary Everglades National Park long into the future. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ann Ball.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Katie and Anne, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedell.